Bodine and Two Wolves drifted away from the column and went their separate ways. Each had to erase the sight of the massacre from their mind, and each had to do it in his own way. Sam Two Wolves rode in search of his father's burial site, and Matt Bodine sought peace of mind. For the Cheyenne and the Sioux, the victory at the Little Bighorn would be their last. Within 2 years, the majority of the Plains tribes would be on reservations, for the Army, after the humiliation at what was being called Custer's last stand, would become relentless in their pursuit of the Indians. Bodine spent the summer alone, riding aimlessly along the Montana-Wyoming border. Two Wolves finally located his father's burial site, after speaking with various bands of Indians. His father's body wrapped in a blanket, suspended high in the air on a lonely ridge. Two Wolves picked sweet sage and sprinkled it around the site and on himself to purify both. Then he prayed and fasted. Visions drew both sons back to the Little Bighorn. They were not surprised to meet one another. The ghosts of Little Bighorn spoke to them. They would never mention those ghostly riders to anyone, and they would seldom talk about them to each other. But both knew what they saw, and they knew better than to question the order of nature. Tom Thomas, his empire shattered, his men scattered, and Terry Kelly gone to God only know where, decided to ride west. He awakened one morning with fear clutching his heart with cold fingers. He was surrounded by Indians, Lone Dog smiling down at him.
Tom Thomas, do you believe it is a good day to die?
Bodine and Two Wolves returned to their home range as summer was waning. Bodine's parents took one look at the young men and knew they had changed. They did not know the how or the why of it, only that it had happened. They respectfully did not press the point.
The army found what was left of Tom Thomas. From the look of things, it wasn't an easy death.
Lone Dog?
The scout thinks so. Did you boys stop by the battleground at the Little Bighorn?
We did.
Samuel, was your father?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
My father died a warrior's death counting coup. I believe he went on the hill to die.
What makes you so sure?
I have talked to Indians who were in the battle. My father was armed only with a coup stick.
Well, I reckon you boys will settle down now and ranch, right?
The young men exchanged glances.
Wrong.
Boy! You're 25 years old, damn it! You both have ranches that could be moneymakers. They are moneymakers. What in the Sam Hill are you two gonna do?
Drift.
Drift? Two 25-year-old kids.
It won't be forever, Dad. And I wish I could tell you the reasons, but that's gonna have to stay locked up for a time. I'm truly sorry.
Are you wanted by the law, boys?
No, Dad. No. Both of us have gotta go up into the timber in the High Lonesome. Call it an inner search, if you will.
Your sister's getting married next month.
I'm glad, but I won't be here.
What about your ranch, boy?
I'll give Carl a working interest in it. I'll draw up the papers and you can witness it.
Well, that's fair. The boy needs to get out of this house and stand on his own. Two Wolves?
Slim Man is on my place now. I will hire others to help him. It is settled.
I reckon it is. I only hope that someday you boys will tell me why you're doing this.
Bodine drew up the papers, giving his brother a share in the ranch in exchange for his staying on it and running the sprawling spread. A large responsibility for one so young, but in the West, one grew up quickly.
You boys picked a hell of a time to get itchy feet. What with winter looking us in the face? Where are you heading?
We honestly don't know, Dad. South, for sure, but how far south is up for grabs?
I have never been to Arizona. I have talked to people who have told me about the deserts there. I would like to see them.
Way I hear it, it's too damn hot for my tastes. You boys be sure to post Mrs. Bodine a letter every now and then. Women get right touchy about things like that.
I shall write her regularly. That way I know that she will at least hear from one of us.
Very funny, all right.
It'll damn sure be the first time.
Bodine and Two Wolves got to the west side of the Powder and looked at each other.
You serious about heading south, brother?
I certainly have no desire to ride north with winter coming.
They pointed their horses south. They would follow the Powder all the way down to the South Fork and then leave the river, heading into the Rattlesnake Hills and then over to cross the Sweetwater, staying to the east of the Green Mountains and the Great Divide Basin, which was not the most hospitable place in which to wander. They lost track of the days as they drifted, but they were forever being reminded of the slaughter they had witnessed at the Little Bighorn. Nearly every person they met on the trail, Indian and white, when they learned Bodine and Two Wolves were from the upper Wyoming country, wanted to know if they knew anything about the great battle between Custer and the Sioux and Cheyenne. Bodine and Two Wolves would tell them no and let the subject lie. As they proceeded south, they began hearing about a beautiful blonde woman running a bar down on the North Platte in the Medicine Bow Mountains. She was young and a real looker. Worth the price of a drink just to look at her.
Has to be.
Yeah, Terry Kelly. Want to drop in for a drink and some friendly conversation?
Why not?
They were still days away from the Medicine Bow Range, with no plan to hurry along just to see Terry. One evening, they shared their campfire with a grizzled old trapper with a tale to tell about the blonde young barmaid.
Yeah, she got some gun slicks with her. Story is, she robbed some rich man up in Montana. Used to own a whole town up there, he did. So the talk goes. She grabbed his poke and run out one night, she did. Her and some Texas gunfighter named Walker. He's a bad one, boys, and mighty jealous of that blonde-haired woman. I'd fight shy of that place if I was you.
He's had gun hands. How many?
Oh, no telling. They come and go, maybe 10, maybe 30. Salty bunch. That place of hers is worse than them joints out on the Barbary Coast. Lots of folks gone in them bat wings and come out dead through the back door. Pockets all turned inside out.
They continued south.
What are we striving to be, brother? Robin Hoods of the West?
I'm on no mission of mercy, Two Wolves. If folks want to get robbed and beat up and tossed in the alley, that's their business. I want a hot bath, good food that I can eat sitting at a table, and some corn for Rowdy. But we don't have to get it in Terry's town.
I'd never hear the end of it if we didn't. You'd be complaining about it all the way to Arizona.
They were still arguing when they rode into the little town. They rode in quietly, stopping first at the stables and seeing to their horses, then walking across the street and checking into the hotel. They went to a barbershop for a haircut and bath in tubs out back of the shop while they sent a boy over to the general store for fresh long handles and jeans and shirts and socks. They had wiped the dust from their guns and checked the action carefully, loading the cylinders up full. Two Wolves had taken to wearing a second gun, the left-hand gun butt forward. Scrubbed clean of dirt and any fleas they might have gathered during the long, dusty days on the trail, the two young men resupplied for their journey, took the supplies back to the hotel, and then walked across the street to a cafe for a hot meal. They ate well and polished off a pot of coffee, conscious of the cafe's counterman eyeballing them.
I know you. You're Bodine.
That's right.
And you'd be the half-breed, Two Wolves. Thought it was you, Bodine. Seen you when you was just a kid, back when them hard cases braced you after that stagecoach run, when they tried to rob you of that gold you was guarding. You boys heading over to the saloon?
We might be.
Thought that might be the case. I'll just close up early and head on over there for a drink. The meal and the coffee's on the house.
That's very kind of you, but why the generosity?
Yeah, this used to be a right nice little village. Had us a church and a little school for the kids to learn. Then that damn Terry woman and them gunslicks of hers come in. Must have been 25 or 30 killings over the past few months. That woman is evil, boys, and that Walker is a devil. He's supposed to have been killed a dozen times over the years, but he's still standing in his boots and still raising old Nick with them guns of his.
I never heard of anyone or any gang ever treeing a town.
Oh, the town wasn't treed right off. Terry and them gun hands of hers was too smart to just ride in and do that. First the town marshal was killed. shot in the back one night. We got us another one, and he went out the same way. No one else wanted the job. The church and the school was burnt down. The mayor got himself all involved with that blonde-haired witch. Kind of went downhill from then on, if you know what I mean.
Only too well. Can you handle a gun?
Sure can. I rode cavalry in the war between the states. There's about a half dozen of us in town who still got the belly for some gunplay.
You round them up. We're going to go back to the hotel and sit in the lobby, read the papers. Give us a sign when you're ready. How many people does Terry have on her payroll?
25 or 30. Most of them gun hands. She's into all sorts of things. Robbing, rustling, killing. You name it, she's been a party to it.
Bodine and Two Wolves made their way to the hotel lounge and passed some time reading the newspapers. It wasn't long before the counterman, Max, walked by the hotel and nodded at the young man. He had a six-gun belted on and wore it like he knew how to use it. It was early in the afternoon, but the saloon was bustling. Bodine nodded at Max, and the man walked on. Bodine waved a boy over to his side. Bodine handed the lad a note.
Now, go over to the saloon and give this to Walker. Here, and take a dollar for your trouble.
The boy was off in a flash.
What'd the note say?
Dear Walker, you big blowhard. You've been flapping that big fat mouth about how you're better with a gun than I am. Now's the time to prove it, providing your big fat butt hasn't overloaded your mouth. Yours, Bodine.
You do have a way with words.
Mister, I don't have no idea what you wrote on that paper, but you sure caused Mr. Walker to lose his temper and cuss. Lordy, did he cuss!
Fine, boy. Now you get over there with the desk clerk and the both of you stay away from the windows.
Bodine and Two Wolves walked to the windows and looked out. The street was empty. The counterman and his men should be getting into position on the rooftops. Bodine and Two Wolves slipped the hammer thongs free and stepped out onto the boardwalk. Walker and a dozen of his men stood on the boardwalk in front of the saloon.
You're expecting Walker to meet you alone, brother?
One can always hope. Anyway, I have a plan. It just came to me. That man from the cafe and his people are in position on the roofs, right?
We hope.
Well, why don't we shorten the distance by about half a block and just start shooting into the mob of them all bunched up there on the boardwalk? You ready?
Let's do it. Lead on, Bodine.
They began walking up the boardwalk.
Now!
The men on the rooftops opened fire with rifles, pistols, and shotguns just as the guns of Bodine and Two Wolves roared. At Bodine's yell, Walker had dived back through the back lanes into the saloon. A half a dozen gun hands were killed during the first volley, and the others were down.
I'm going around back. I'll see you in a minute.
Bodine ran into the alley. Bodine rounded the corner and ran right into a gun slick, knocking him sprawling. Bodine kicked the man and went in through the back door of the saloon. He threaded his way through the murk of the dark storeroom, which was filled with kegs of beer and cases of whiskey. The door suddenly flew open, and a man stood there, a sawed-off shotgun in his hands. Bodine shot him twice and grabbed up the shotgun, searching the man for shells and finding a handful. He checked the weapon and slipped away from the door. Just as he changed positions, half a dozen guns barked from within the saloon, and the door was riddled. Bodine fired through a small, dirty window, giving several gunnies standing at the bar both barrels. Bodine again shifted locations, reloading the sawed-off as he moved. Bodine spotted stairs leading to the second floor and took them quietly. He stepped out onto a balcony, lifted the shotgun, and blew away two more of Terry's hired guns. He dropped the shotgun and filled his hands with Colts just as Walker stepped into view. The man jerked and stumbled each time the lead struck him, the bullets driving him back against the bar. He died with his elbows hooked onto the bar railing and his blood leaking onto the floor.
You rotten son of a bitch! You can't do this to me!
Terry's behind hit the seat of the wagon, and the reins were pressed into her soft, pretty hands. reins that were attached to two mules. The bed of the wagon was filled with wounded gun hands, patched up by the local doctor without benefit of laudanum. Bodine slapped a mule on the rump.
Yeah! See you around, Terry!
I'll get you for this, Bodine. You and that damn half-breed! I'll see you in hell for this!
Bodine and two wolves swung into the saddle and headed out. But with it, they both knew another notch had been carved deeply into their already growing reputations.
Do you suppose, Bodine, that when our luck begins to turn bad, we'll have enough sense to hang it up and go back home?
I sure hope so, brother. I surely do.
The two young men galloped south, letting their horses run for a time, carrying them into the unknown. They were brothers of the wolf, bonded by blood. If you chose to fight one, you had to fight the other. And they knew that destiny pulled them south.
Look, Bodine, a message. It's a sign.
A great old lobo wolf stood on a knoll, watching them through wise eyes.
Blood Bond is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2007, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Thomas Penny, Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, David Coyne, James Konacek, Nanette Savard, Jeff Baker, Sonny Lasky, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Tim Carlin, Michael Roplogel, Bruce Rauscher, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Nanette Savard. Dialogue editing by Johan Detweiler, Carlos Anderson, and Christian Parent. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton and Christian Parent. Additional original music by Brian Patton, Johan Detweiler, and Greg Reinfeld. Book adapted for graphic audio by Casey Jones. Produced by Rick Rowan and Wayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Blood Bond, be sure to look for the Eagles series, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2007, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode 4, In for Repair.
Even though Mark Dalton left BC Place soon after the police arrived, he spent the rest of the day with the RCMP, writing and signing statements so that proper charges could be laid against the crooked shipper, Bradley J. Proctor, and the rest of the people involved with his insurance scam.
Now, you're sure you can make it back out here for the trial if it goes that far? If you don't show up, the Crown Prosecutor won't have as strong a case.
You've got my statement.
Yes, and that's a big help, but it's not as good for leverage as the threat of you testifying at trial. If I have your assurance you'll be there, their lawyers might even try and cut a deal today.
Mark wasn't too keen on promising he'd be anywhere at a specific date and time. What if some cash cow of a load bound for Mexico got hooked up to his truck the week he was supposed to be in Vancouver for the trial? He'd have to pass it up just to tell a jury what he already told the police. And even at that, Bradley J. Proctor seemed like the kind of guy who would have a tricky lawyer in his back pocket. The kind of guy who could beat long-distance phone charges if he wanted. But then again, if he did show up in court, he would be getting a bad shipper out of the business. A guy who tried to use a hard-working owner-operator to take the fall for his failed business venture. That alone should have been enough to make Mark want to be in the courtroom. Not only to see it happen, but to help make it so. He'd already decided to cooperate fully with the police, but he knew for the next few minutes he held all the cards, and might as well play his hand.
Can you put me up in a hotel?
As many nights as we need you.
Meals, too?
Meals, too.
All right. Then just give me a few weeks' notice.
I can give you a few months.
I'll be here.
Outside the police station, Dalton walked slowly across the wet asphalt of the parking lot toward his rig. He wondered where he'd be headed next. He was hoping for someplace warm where he could get a bit of sun. California, maybe. That'd be sweet. Mark climbed up into his rig and started it up. Then he dialed up his dispatcher, Bud, while the Peterbilt's engine idled.
Yeah.
It's Mark. Mark Dalton.
Even though Mark was the only Mark Bud dispatched, the way Bud answered the phone always gave Mark the feeling that he didn't know exactly who was calling.
I know who you are.
And you know why I'm calling.
You want a load would be my guess.
I'm in Vancouver.
I know where you are. Just give me a minute, will you?
Mark shook his head. Every call to Bud was an adventure, and not the kind of adventure Mark enjoyed. Every word he said was the wrong one, and every attempt at making a little joke always fell flat.
All right. There's a load of 6 giant wind machines in the port. They were being used on a movie set on Oahu, and now they have to be in Collinwood by next Friday. You're gonna be using them on some movie called Snowflakes.
Who's in the movie?
Shannon Tweed.
Shannon Tweed? The direct-to-video queen?
I guess.
Bud obviously didn't know who he was talking about. It could have been Captain Queeg for all he knew.
Hey, maybe I'll get to meet her.
Yeah, she'll probably be signing for the load when you get there.
Well, you never know. Low-budget Canadian movie, maybe everyone pitches in.
Yeah, well, maybe you should be worrying about getting the load instead of delivering it.
Why? What do you mean?
Don't you read the papers while you're out there?
I haven't had time yet.
Well, you got time now. Those wind machines are being held up along with everything else in the port while a bunch of owner-operators are out on strike. Shutting down the shipping yard until they start getting an hourly rate for the time they spend in line waiting for a load.
An hourly rate for owner-operators?
It seems like they don't like waiting 3 hours for a load that takes them an hour to deliver. Guys have been lining up at 5 a.m. to be first in line when the gate opens at 8.
Really?
Geez, Dalton, don't you ever read the trades?
When I find them, racks are always empty by the time I get there.
Maybe I'll start keeping the back issues for you then.
Hey, I'd appreciate that.
Bud gave Mark the details on the load, and after they said goodbye, Mark pulled out of the police lot and found a donut shop just down the street with a newspaper box out in front. He bought a coffee inside the shop, and a copy of the Vancouver Province on his way back to his truck. Once inside, he began flipping pages, and it wasn't long before he came across a feature story on the ongoing labor dispute. Apparently, it was just as Bud had said. The local owner-operators were tired of waiting up to 3 hours for a load that paid a flat rate. They were asking for close to $50 an hour, which would probably speed things up in the port some, and even if it didn't, the operators wouldn't mind waiting in line. But while the dispute had been going on for a month, Mark was happy to learn that a vote was going to be taken on the port's most recent offer tomorrow night. He hoped the operators got what they wanted, and while the article clearly stated that this dispute had no effect on long-distance haulers like himself, which meant he could probably get into the port and pick up his load if he really wanted, that would force him to go up against the operators who were out on strike. They were guys just like him, trying to make a decent living wage, and he didn't want to do anything, no matter how small, to hurt their fight. Besides, if they accepted this latest offer, it would open the port Friday morning, and he'd still be able to pick up the load with more than enough time to deliver it on schedule. In the meantime, he would have a day or two to get the clutch on mother load adjusted. He'd had a rebuilt one installed about 100,000 kilometers ago, and now that it was settled in, it could use a little adjustment. He drove into Surrey to the Peterbilt dealership on 96th Avenue and spoke to a service rep there.
Wouldn't take too long to make the adjustment, half hour or so.
That's great.
But I can't get anyone on it until the middle of next week.
What do you mean? You guys always have 2 or 3 mechanics doing small jobs.
We usually do, but I got one mechanic on his honeymoon and the other two have got trucks lined up around the lot because of the strike.
Oh.
With the strike going on, a lot of operators figured it was a pretty good time to get their rigs serviced. Especially now, seeing as it looks like they're gonna vote to accept the latest offer. Everyone wants their truck ready for Friday, and I can't slip another one in before then. Some of these guys have already been waiting a week. Sorry.
No problem. I understand.
Anyway, there's plenty of good shops in the area that can handle an adjustment.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe I'll try one.
They shook hands and Mark headed back to his rig. As he started it up, he thought about letting the adjustment wait until he got back to his regular mechanic in Toronto. But it was such a minor thing now. If he let it go too long, who knows what it might cost him to fix down the road. He drove around the block looking for a place to bring Motherload. He found plenty of service centers, but none that seemed to service full-size trucks exclusively. If Mark was going to have anyone other than the dealer look at his rig, he at least wanted the mechanic to be familiar with Peterbilt's. Just when he thought he'd try another part of the city, Mark found a place tucked in behind a warehouse. It had a fenced-in yard, which suggested his rig would be safe there if he had to leave it overnight. And there were plenty of Peterbilts, Freightliners, and other assorted trucks around the lot, which told him the work they did was good enough to keep people coming back. Finally, the building itself looked well-maintained, with a large lighted sign out front, suggesting that business was good. The sign read, Rick's Rigs. Mark sat on the road in front of the shop, considering what he should do. He hated the idea of taking his truck to a place he didn't know, but his clutch needed some attention now rather than later. And besides, it was only an adjustment. What could go wrong?
Are you Rick?
Yeah, Rick's Rigs, that's me.
He was wearing a clean pair of jeans and a heavy light blue sweater. The collar of the shirt under the sweater was crisp and clean, and judging by the rest of the guy's appearance, he was doing pretty well for himself without having to get his hands very dirty to do it. So he was a good businessman. Mark couldn't hold that against him.
I need to have my clutch adjusted.
Is it slipping?
Not really. I just want a little more play at the bottom end. Right now the pedal has to be all the way down for it to disengage, and I'd like a little more play in it.
No problem.
Can you do it today?
I can get started on it right away. And if all it needs is an adjustment like you say, well, it should be ready by 5.
Oh, that's great. I've got a load waiting for me, and I'd hate to see it go to someone else.
Good to know you're working.
Of course I'm working. You know any other way to make a living?
Mark wasn't sure what to make of the man's grin, but it unsettled him. In a way, it reminded him of a lot of the men he'd talked to when he was a private investigator working on divorce cases. He would ask some guy if he knew some woman, and they'd smile and say something like, "Oh yeah, she's a nice girl, bakes the best chocolate chip cookies in the office." And meanwhile, the guy was having sex with her every chance he got. That was the same sort of smile on Rick's face now, like he was a best friend who just happened to be screwing your wife when you weren't around. Rick shrugged his shoulders, but the smile never left his face. After leaving the shop, Mark put his spare set of keys in the ignition of his rig, picked up his jacket, wallet, and a few other essentials, and hopped on a bus to a nearby mall. Since he basically lived out of his truck, there wasn't a whole lot of things he needed. But it was nice to buy a new shirt, pair of shoes, or some new CD every once in a while to remind himself that his life wasn't just about driving a truck all the time. He eventually found his way into a Smith Books, and although there wasn't anything in this store that he couldn't find in any Indigo or Chapters, he checked the fiction section for any new Lawrence Block novels. He didn't find anything new, but there was a reissue of an older novel, Tanner's 12 Swingers, featuring Block's international man of mystery, Evan Tanner, that he didn't read before. Mark picked it up, knowing it would be good for a few hours of distraction. He spent another hour at the mall reading the book over a few cups of coffee, then made his way back to Rick's Rigs just before 6.
It's not ready yet.
What? Why not?
We had a rebuilt transmission come in, and I had to put 2 men on the installation. We'll get to your truck in the morning and be ready by noon tomorrow.
All right. I'll be in tomorrow, early afternoon. It'll be ready then, right?
Yeah, ready and able.
He'd been promised something, and it hadn't been delivered. That went against everything the trucking industry was about, on-time delivery. He took another moment to compose himself, realizing it was really no big deal. After all, he wasn't going anywhere until Friday, so it wasn't as if the delay was screwing up his schedule. So he had to spend a night in a hotel. Worse things had happened, and besides, he could use a decent night's rest in a hotel, seeing as his last overnight stay at the budget motoring inn outside of Calgary hadn't gone all that well. Mark turned to leave.
Hey, you need a ride somewhere?
That would be nice.
Well, Harry's just leaving.
Rick gestured to a man in a moose head baseball cap and a pair of denim overalls.
Harry! You mind giving this guy a ride?
Can do.
Thanks.
Mark got his overnight bag from his truck and hurried to catch up with Harry, who drove a Freightliner FLD-120 with new Brunswick plates. White in color and plenty of polished chrome on the corners.
Hey there.
Mark climbed into the cab. The inside of the rig was immaculate and even smelled a bit like a brand new truck. Obviously, Harry took good care of his rig, and Rick's Rigs was doing a pretty good job of servicing it.
Nice truck.
Yeah, it looks good. Runs good, too, when it wants. Lately, it don't want a whole hell of a lot.
It can't be that old.
1994.
How many kilometers on it?
Not as many as it should have.
Mark watched Harry run through the gears. He was gentle with his shifts, and he didn't seem to stomp on the pedals like some drivers he knew. The truck was running smooth and steady, and if he didn't know it was a 1994 model, Mark might have guessed it to be just a year or two old.
What kind of problems have you had with it?
You name it. Seems every time I'm out on this coast, Rick finds something wrong with it. New axle, rebuilt transmission, steering linkages. I have to admit, Rick does a good job. After he fixes something, I never have any trouble with it again. I just hope I run out of stuff for him to fix pretty soon. A few more repairs like the last one, and I'll be a company driver again.
I don't want to tell you how to run your business, but that seems like an awful lot of repairs for the mileage you got on it.
Yeah, thoughts cross my mind too, but I've talked to some of the other drivers getting work done at Rick's Rigs, and they all seem to be in the same boat as me.
Mark wanted to say something, suggest Harry get his truck fixed somewhere else, but decided to save his breath. Harry didn't seem all that unhappy about all the work being done on his truck, and he seemed to be doing all right despite the problems. But even though he was holding his tongue, that didn't do anything to relieve the bad feeling in Mark's gut. There seemed to be something not right about Harry and his rig, and Mark hoped it had more to do with Harry than it did with the place he got his truck fixed. Harry brought his rig to a stop and nodded to his right.
Here you go. This is where I stay whenever I need a night's rest on the coast.
They stopped in front of a motel called the Welcome Inn. It was a two-story independent and looked fairly well-maintained, and despite the fact that Harry stayed there, Mark decided it would be okay for a night. There were plenty of trucks parked out front, and it was within walking distance of Rick's Rigs. Besides, all he was going to be doing was getting a bite to eat and going to bed, and the Welcome Inn looked as if it could accommodate both those needs all right. Dinner was a simple steak and potatoes special, and after dinner he retired to his room, where he tuned into the Canucks game on TSN. During the first intermission, Mark got to thinking about a woman named Cindy he'd met the last time he was out on the coast. She lived in Vancouver, seemed to have a thing for truckers, and if he was lucky, he might be able to meet up with her for a drink and a few laughs. He fished his address book out of his overnight bag and found her number under the seas.
Hello.
Mark hadn't been expecting that. Although considering how fond his memory of Cindy was, he shouldn't have been surprised that she'd found someone else.
Good evening. My name is Dirk Malton, and I'm calling to ask if you're happy with the service provided by your current long-distance...
Mark smiled, replaced the phone on the night table next to the bed, and checked the score of the hockey game. The Canucks were losing to the Oilers by 4. He shut off the television, made himself comfortable on the bed, and cracked open his paperback. In it, Evan Tanner was currently in Greece on his way to Latvia by way of Macedonia in order to help out a friend named Carlis Milovicius. Then, according to the book's back cover, he would meet up with a former girlfriend in the Soviet Union, who, along with 11 other young women, wanted Tanner to smuggle her into the United States. Mark lost himself in the novel, escaping into Tanner's world. Wouldn't that be great, he thought between chapters, going from adventure to adventure, not knowing where the winds of fate might take you, not knowing where you might be on the planet from one week to the next. That would be so cool. After eating breakfast in the hotel coffee shop, Mark spent the morning doing a load of laundry at the laundromat near the hotel. When all of his clothes were dry, neatly folded, and back into his overnight bag, he had lunch back at the hotel and then walked over to Rick's Rigs to pick up Motherlode. As he neared the shop, he noticed his truck was parked outside the garage and in the lot, a good sign that the clutch might be adjusted and ready for him. He was met by Rick, who was sipping a cup of coffee out of a paper cup.
Is it ready?
Yep.
Everything go all right?
Nope.
Mark suddenly got a bad feeling in the pit of his stomach.
We had some problem with the bearings when we tried to make the adjustment. Once we took those out to replace, we found a problem with the whole clutch, and we had to replace it with a rebuild.
What?
Yeah, but the clutch is guaranteed for a year, so you won't have to worry about it for a while.
But I just had the clutch replaced about 100,000 kilometers ago. It's supposed to be good for 500,000 clicks or more.
It depends on how you drive it.
Mark didn't like the insinuation. While he wasn't as gentle with his rig as Harry was, he never rode the clutch, never popped it either. There was no way he'd used up a rebuilt clutch in such a short period of time. Either the clutch he had installed back in Toronto was bad to begin with, or Rick here was trying to rip him off. It wasn't too hard to believe it was the latter.
Okay, first of all, there was nothing wrong with the clutch. All it needed was an adjustment. Second, even if it did need replacing, you shouldn't have done anything without getting my okay first.
I tried to get a hold of you, but you didn't leave us a number. You said you needed the truck by Friday, and if we waited, we might not have got the parts on time, and you would have lost your load.
Mark realized he hadn't given them his cell number, but if nothing else, they could have waited for him to come in this morning to let him know what the truck needed.
Comes to $2,386.30.
He produced a receipt for the clutch, showing the amount he had supposedly paid for it.
And it gave you a deal on the clutch. My cost.
Well, I'm not paying for any rebuilt clutch.
And you won't be getting your truck back.
Mark felt anger rising up inside of him. That truck was his business, his home, his life. He'd worked damn hard for it, and there was no way he was going to let some rip-off repair shop just take it from him for a measly $2,000. Sure, he could pay the bill, write it off as an expense, and barely notice it by the end of the year. But there were a lot of other things he could do with $2,000 that would put more money in his pocket next year. Hell, he could even spend it on a trip to somewhere hot. He'd be out of pocket just the same, but at least he'd have had a damn good time spending the money. Mark just stood there looking at Rick and wanting to knock that stupid smile right off the man's face. But while he was sure he could take Rick, the office suddenly seemed full of greasy, big-armed mechanics, each holding a steel wrench in his hand. Even the shop's dog, an old Doberman that looked as if it had gotten under a few wheels in its lifetime, hobbled into the office, sat down on the floor next to Mark, and bared its teeth.
I'll be back.
$2,386.30!
Might as well have been $2 million, thought Mark. He wasn't paying it.
This guy's trying to rip me off for $2,000.
Constable Rob Quentin nodded, as if he'd heard similar complaints before.
He probably is.
What do you mean?
Let's just say we're aware of this guy.
You mean he's done this before?
Did he show you a receipt for the clutch? Told you he was charging his cost for it?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Rick DeLuca of Rick's Rigs also owns a truck parts company. Unfortunately, most of what he supplies through that company is receipts to his repair shop.
You know this and you haven't shut him down?
We're currently investigating DeLuca and Rick's Rigs, but we've got a week or two to go get the rest of what we need to make all the charges stick.
None of which helps me any. And why me anyway?
I am afraid they saw you coming.
Meaning?
You've got a late model, well-maintained truck, which means you've got some money to spend on repairs. You've got out-of-province plates, meaning you're probably homesick, being out here on the coast, and you want to get back home as soon as you can. And you've got a load waiting for you, which means you're probably in a hurry. You see, they didn't expect any problems from you. What you were supposed to do is pay the bill and be on your merry way.
Mark just shook his head and wondered why so many people thought he was the kind of guy they could pull a fast one on.
Yeah, well, they're going to be having some real problems now.
What you mean by that?
I'm not paying that bill, and I'm not leaving my truck there.
You're not thinking of stealing it, are you?
Stealing it? It's my truck.
I tell you what, why don't you meet me there this afternoon and we can work this out? You can get your truck back and be on your merry way.
I'm not paying that bill.
Well, see what we can work out.
All right.
You've just got to promise me that you'll testify in court against them if it goes that far.
If you recall, I've already agreed to be here to testify against Bradley J. Proctor. If you make the trials coincide, I'll already be in town.
Oh, let me check on that.
The constable picked up the phone and exchanged a few words with someone, most likely a provincial prosecutor. At last, he hung up the phone, smiling more broadly.
It's doable. In fact, they like the idea of saving some money on your accommodations if both cases go to trial.
Things are tough all over, aren't they?
What time do you want me to meet you there?
Mark was back in Rick's Riggs' office at 4 that afternoon.
I've come for my truck.
Cash, credit, debit card, or money order?
In the distance, Mark could hear a cry of police sirens approaching. It sounded as if there was more than one siren, as if a half dozen patrol cars were on their way to back up Constable Quinton's attempts to get Mark's rig back.
I'm not paying for parts and repairs that were A, unnecessary, B, unapproved, and C, probably not even done. And even if you did replace the clutch like you say, you're still charging me twice what the repair should actually cost.
Are you saying that I'm trying to rip you off?
That's exactly what I'm saying, Rick. Maybe the sign should read Rick's Ripoffs instead of Rick's Rigs.
Rick looked angry. So did the mechanics who stepped into the office. Even the dog was there growling near Mark's feet. The sound of the sirens began to fade.
You guys all look pretty tough stealing money out of the pockets of hard-working truckers. What do you do for kicks on the weekends? Roll old ladies for bingo money?
The office was silent except for the growling of a dog and the scrape of work boots on concrete as Rick and his mechanics moved in on Mark. Mark ran the tip of his fingers over the blue teabag-sized shiner that had puffed out under his right eye.
I heard the sirens coming. What the hell happened?
Awfully sorry about that. I was on my way there with two other units, but we got diverted on the way.
Was there a sale on donuts you just couldn't pass up?
He regretted the comment the moment it escaped his lips, but he couldn't stop himself. He was bruised all over, his ribs ached, and several of his teeth were threatening to drop out of his head, and he still didn't have his truck back. In short, he was angry and he wanted to lash out at the world, cops included. Constable Quinton stared at Mark with a look that could melt a glacier.
No, one of my fellow officers was getting shot at, so he thought it might be a good idea if we gave him a hand.
Is he all right?
He took a shot in the leg. But I guess it's not much compared to what you went through last night, is it?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's just that I have a load that I have to have on the road by tomorrow morning, and Shannon Tweed's waiting.
What?
Never mind.
Look, I'll meet you there tomorrow morning when they open up. Make sure you're on your way as soon as possible.
Sure, okay.
He had no intention of picking up his truck in the morning. When the sun came up, he'd be at the port, picking up his load.
Do you have a card in case I want to get in touch with you between now and then?
Of course.
Do you have two? I'll see you tomorrow morning then.
When Mark got back to the hotel room, he cleaned himself up as best he could while watching the news for anything on the trucker strike. According to the report on the local CBC station, the owner-operators had agreed to the port's offer of an hourly wage. Furthermore, the port would be open for business tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. That was good news for Mark, since it meant he would be able to pick up his load in the morning. However, without his rig, he wouldn't be picking up anything, and with the port open, there was no reason why they'd hold the load for him. All of which meant he had to do something tonight. Mark checked out of the hotel after dinner. He'd been tempted to leave that detail until the morning, since he was paying for the room anyway. But if things went well, he wouldn't need to come back. He walked a couple of blocks before he found a strip mall that had an assortment of stores that carried what he needed. At the supermarket, he picked up a good-sized roast. Then it was on to the hardware store, where he bought 50 meters of nylon cord, a can of silver spray paint, a heavy-duty lock, and a pair of bolt cutters. After spending a couple of hours in the mall's coffee shop reading the local papers, he set out for Rick's Riggs around 11 o'clock. When he reached the shop, he noticed they left his truck out in the lot, which was the first real break in this whole stupid business. Another break was that the lot had nothing in the way of security cameras. He hadn't thought to look for them before. There had been no need to. But he suspected Rick wasn't the type to pay for such things, as they'd be just as helpful catching him and his mechanics in a crime as they would anyone else. The only nighttime security device in the yard, other than the fence, was likely the dog. Mark hadn't seen him yet, but he expected he'd be coming around any time now. He went around the back of the shop, away from the streetlights where it was dark. He found a white cube van parked against the fence and decided to scale the chain link there. He started up the outside of the fence, and just as he reached the top of it, He heard a door to the garage open and then the clicking of a dog's claws as it ambled over to see what was going on. Before the dog could start barking, Mark fished inside his shopping bag and grabbed the roast. He broke the seal of the plastic wrap with his finger, then dropped it to the ground. The dog sniffed at the meat, then began working at it, trying to get it out of the plastic. While the dog was busy with that, Mark climbed down the inside of the fence. When his feet hit the pavement, the dog looked at him cautiously a moment, as if it knew it was supposed to do something but didn't want to lose the meat by doing it. Mark waited until the dog went back to the roast, then moved slowly around the cube van. When he reached the back of the van, he rolled up the door of the box. With the dog still occupied with the roast, he took one of the keys to the padlock he'd bought and attached it to the dog's collar. Then, in one swift motion, he grabbed the roast and tossed it into the back of the van. The dog followed the meat into the van, and Mark quickly rolled down the door behind it. The dog barked a few times, but it wasn't long before the noise died down, and Mark could hear it gnawing at the meat again. Mark reached into his bag again and took out the nylon cord. He'd wanted blue cord, thinking that would be less conspicuous at night. But now that the dog was in the white van, the yellow cord he purchased was probably the best choice. He tied the cord to the door handle at the back of the van, then tossed the rope over the top of the box, then over the fence. That done, he went behind the garage to the dumpster, where they threw out all the old parts, the ones they actually replaced with new and rebuilt ones. He didn't really expect to find his old clutch there, or even a clutch, since they were always taken by the parts companies in exchange for the part that replaced it, so they could be rebuilt. Nevertheless, he did find something that looked a little like a clutch, and that was all he needed. He took the can of silver spray paint from his bag and pulled the old part out of the pile. Then he snapped the cap off the can and began painting the old part until it was silver all around and looking like a new whatever it was. He left it there to dry and went to go check on his truck. He used his key to unlock the door to Mother Lode and was relieved to see the cab light come on when he opened the door. The battery was still connected. He climbed inside the cab, slid the key into the ignition, and turned it. Nothing. He'd expected that. If Rick's Rigs had been treating customers like this for a while, then they were probably in the habit of disabling trucks in these types of situations. Luckily, there were a couple of easy and effective ways of disabling Peterbilts like his 379, and he knew what both of them were. First, while he was in the cab, he checked the ECM wires behind the dash panel. It took a bit of work to get the dash panel free, but when it came away, it revealed that the fuses had all been undone. Mark reconnected them, then tried starting the truck again. This time, it turned over, but wouldn't catch. That probably meant they'd done something to the engine compartment, like disconnect the oil pressure sensor plug. To check that, Mark would have to crack open the hood, but at least he knew what he was looking for, and therefore wouldn't be too conspicuous for long. He got out of the truck and undid the hood latches. In the distance, he could hear the muted barks of the dog, which was probably finished with the roast and realizing where it was. With a smile, Mark climbed up the front bumper and pulled on the hood. It slowly fell forward, and Mark was careful to bring it gently to rest in the upright position. Using a pen light to peer into the engine compartment, Mark immediately saw that the plug was undone. In seconds, he had the plug back in place and the hood lowered over the engine. Now, if all went well, the truck would turn over and start, and he'd be on his way. But before any of that could happen, there were a few more things that needed to be taken care of. First, Mark went to the gate, cut the lock with the new bolt cutters he bought, and opened the gate. Then he ran back to his truck, climbed into the cab, and put his hand on the key in the ignition. He waited for the glow plugs to warm up.
Here goes nothing.
He turned the key. The engine turned over a few times, then roared to life. Mark let out a sigh of relief, then slowly released the clutch. There was just the right amount of play in the pedal's swing, and the engagement of engine and transmission was smooth as silk.
Well, at least they did a good job with that.
Mark moved his truck out of the yard and parked it on the road across the street. Then he jumped out of the truck, ran back into the yard, and around to the back of the garage. He picked up the silver-painted clutch out of the pile of junk collected there and brought it around front to the spot where Mother Lode had been parked. After reaching inside his jacket, Mark produced a business envelope with the word Rick written on the outside in black pen. He placed the envelope on the ground, then put the clutch on top of it, holding the envelope down like a giant paperweight. That done, he headed out of the yard, stopping at the gate to pull it closed and lock it up with the new lock he'd picked up at the hardware store. Now there was just one more thing to be done. He walked around to the back of the lot where the yellow nylon cord hung from the top of the fence like a tassel. He pulled on the cord and, as if by magic, the dog's barking suddenly rose several decibels. The dog ran to the fence, barking and snarling at Mark as if it understood what had happened and knew that it would be in Rick's doghouse for weeks to come.
Say hello to Rick for me.
The dog's barking continued for several minutes, but it was eventually drowned out by the sound of Mark's diesel engine running up through the gears. Rick DeLuca slipped his key in the lock at the gate to Rick's rigs, but couldn't get the lock to open. He reinserted the key several times, but the thing wouldn't budge. Then he noticed that the lock was newer and a bit different than he remembered.
What the... What do you know about this, Max?
He noticed the dog walking toward him with its tail low between its legs. There was a key attached to its collar.
Come here, boy.
The dog's tail began to wag as it neared the fence.
Come here!
When the dog was up against the fence, he reached through one of the larger holes in the links and removed the key from its collar. Then he tried the key and the lock snicked open. Max barked a couple of times and began running to the right, as if he wanted Rick to see something. A few steps into the lot and Rick saw it. Someone had spray-painted a torque converter from a school bus silver and left it in the middle of the lot. He pushed the torque converter aside with his foot and saw an envelope lying there with his name on it. He opened it up and found a letter inside, along with a couple of other slips of paper. He read the letter.
Dear Rick, I picked up my truck last night. The clutch works great now, thanks. Payment for the adjustment is enclosed. I know you said you installed a rebuilt clutch for me, but seeing as I didn't need it, I'm leaving this one for you in return. Although this one isn't much like the one you said you installed in my truck, it actually exists, so that probably puts you one up on me. But I don't mind being shortchanged on that account since, well, it's fair payback for all the bruised knuckles I caused you and your mechanics with my head, face, and ribs. If you want to report any of this to the RCMP, I've enclosed the card of Constable Rob Quentin. He's already familiar with your operation and wants to speak with you about it anyway. Come to think of it, this might be the perfect opportunity for you two strangers to finally meet. Either way, I'll be out on the coast in a few months and I'll probably run into you then. I'll be the one at the courthouse, waving to you from the witness stand. But first, I've got a date with Shannon Tweed. All the best, Mark Dalton.
Shannon Tweed?
Be sure to look for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. In July, episode 5 appears in Eagles number 9, Outlanders number 41, MacPolin number 103, and Deathstalker Return number 1.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.